We're looking at what our diet has to do with climate change. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So what we eat and how we grow it has huge implications on our warming planet. Scientists have found that the global food system contributes about 30% of greenhouse gas emissions. So to get to our plate, all along the food chain, we emit planet-warming gases in the production, storage, transportation, the retail, and finally, the actual cooking of our food. So what do you want to know about how your meal choices affect the environment? What dietary changes are you making and why? We're at 800-642-1234. Joe Bozeman is a research associate at the University of Illinois at Chicago Institute for Environmental Science and Policy. He studies the environmental effects of the American diet by demographic group. Joe, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. So set this up for us. Does what I eat at breakfast this morning, my lunch, my dinner, all my guilty, salty snacks during the day have an effect on climate change?
It does. Of course, when you add up a certain style of eating over a period of time, those patterns and trends definitely can have more greenhouse gas impacts than other sorts of diets.
Well, walk us through the food chain, if you will. How exactly does food contribute to global warming?
Well, a lot of folks may not realize that the food we consume has a direct correlation with the manner in which food is produced at the farm gate level, as well as various market and distribution center aspects. The work that I do tends to focus on what's called cradle to farm gate farm activities, which means these activities are mostly raw material inputs and production that's done before the food passes the farm gate and goes out into the market.
So what would those inputs be? I would assume water would be a big one.
Absolutely. The way I like to categorize them simply is in three categories: land use being one, greenhouse gas emissions, which is a combination of various sorts of emissions that equivalent to up to greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide equivalent is what we like to say internally. And then water, of course, water use on a liter per kilogram of food produced rate.
So as you look at these inputs, the land, the greenhouse gas, the water, what are the culprits here? Which foods have the largest impact on what we're seeing on the environment?
So we do have a list of environmentally intense foods. And in the vegetable category, potatoes tend to have the most land, greenhouse gas, and water impacts out of that group. In the fruits category, apples tend to have the highest impact across all categories. And in protein foods, or the red meat and poultry section, we have beef meat, which I think is relatively universally understood as having high impact across the board. Milk in the dairy category, and wheat as a total grain subfood item is one that tends to be environmentally intense compared to the other basic foods we studied.
When you say milk, we cringe here because we're Wisconsin's, you know, America's dairy land. Dairy is in our DNA. Talk a little bit more there about what dairy is doing to the environment.
Now, I want to qualify that statement by saying, you know, I made mention of the most environmentally intense foods within each food group, right?
Mm-hmm.
The basic
yep.
food groups. However, when you compare milk to foods like beef, lamb, and pork, let's use this statistic, for instance. Milk, based on our stats, produces about 1 kilogram of carbon dioxide equivalent per liter produced. And that's compared to beef, which is at 15 kilograms of carbon dioxide equivalent per kilogram of food produced. And these are greenhouse gas emission numbers. So yes, milk does have an impact on the environment like every other food item does.
Mm-hmm.
But quite frankly, our reduction of meat intake is going to help us out when it comes to global environmental degradation.
Talking with Joe Bozeman. He works in environmental science and policy at the University of Illinois at Chicago. We're looking at how our food choices affect climate change. With your questions as well, are you conscious of what you're eating and its effect on the environment? Do you try to eat more vegetables or limit your meat intake? What do you hope this does for our planet? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Joe, sticking with dairy for a moment, something we know here in Wisconsin is that it takes about 10 pounds of milk to make 1 pound of cheese. So is cheese a culprit in climate issues and climate change?
When we think about food commodities, which are mixtures of different food items, cheese does become more of a factor. What we did in our studies to simplify the understanding, even across demographics such as race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic status, we actually broke the foods down to their most basic level. So we like to look at milk as the derivative or the antecedent of all the derivative food items, such as cheese, different food products that milk is a base of. So we don't look at cheese as a single food item, but it is true, cheese does take a lot of milk to produce.
Are some milks, you know, maybe better than others? We pay more for organic milk. What about organic?
You know, our research actually did not come out clear in that regard. There are some organic activities that tend to use less land, greenhouse gas, and water than more conventional food production activities. However, the reverse is true in some cases. We can think about green beans where if we happen to utilize certain food production activities, we might be able to yield more green beans per kilogram using conventional methods rather than organic methods, depending on the farm, the location, the region, the staff. It's very, very complex when it comes to how food is produced and how much resources we use in doing so.
Well, turn this around for us. Which foods have the least effect on our environment, have least effect in greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, this is also not a straightforward answer, but if we think about greenhouse gas in particularly, beans and legumes tend to yield the least amount of greenhouse gas impacts per kilogram produced. Fruits, on the other hand, tend to yield roughly to like the second least when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. When it comes to land, we find that fish and dry beans tend to use the least amount of land resources. And then water, we find that nuts and milk compared to the other food groups tend to use the least amount of water impacts. And this sometimes goes against some of the conventional knowledge you've heard about, well, nuts are water intensive. Yes, compared to beans and other foods within this food group, but not compared to things like beef and lamb.
But if that seafood is being flown in from Alaska or from some far-flung place, I would imagine that transportation there is factoring into that climate footprint.
And that's what makes these relationships so complex. I made mention that fish, when it comes to land use, may be one of the least environmentally intense. However, it's only second or third behind beef and eggs when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. So you're right, fish can have a large impact in one category and have a lesser impact in another category, like land and water.
You have to balance it all out. We're discussing how our diet affects the environment with Joe Bozeman. He's a research associate at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Have you tried to cut down on carbon-intensive foods like beef, like dairy? Are you feeling conflicted about that because of Wisconsin's proud dairy heritage? Did you plant a pandemic garden or shift more to growing your own food in these times? What have you learned about your local food system? Share with us, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Joe Bozeman here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing the role of our diet in global warming. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Scientists say if meat and dairy consumption continues to rise globally as projected, greenhouse gas emissions from egg alone will likely surpass 2050 targets. That's from a study in the journal Nature in recent years that predicted food-related greenhouse gas emissions could increase by 90% over the next 30 years. So here's something. Have you tried an Impossible Burger, a plant-based burger? We grill them at our house. What do you think? Have you joined a CSA? How do you feel connected to your local food system? Let's talk through it. 800-642-1234. Joe Bozeman is with the University of Illinois at Chicago Institute for Environmental Science and Policy. Joe, I want to explore more about meat. Why does meat have such a big impact on climate?
Well, one of the things that some folks may lose in thinking about the way meat gets to your table, from farm to table, we like to use that phrase, is the cultivation of various animals takes so many indirect and byproduct resources to maintain. And it's not necessarily just the animal itself and the butchering and the processing that requires so much energy. It's the food, it's the maize. It's the energy around maintaining the land, the quality of water, things of that sort that really goes in to these calculations.
Does it matter how the cows are raised, like whether they're grass-fed beef?
I think that's more so of a nutrition question than okay. It is a land, greenhouse gas, and water impact dynamic. That being said, we do calculate a range of production approaches based on if maybe a cow was raised in a large area where it could graze, many square meters of land in comparison to a tighter living quarters where maybe the cows are living closer together, things of that sort. So that is estimated into our calculations, but it is not something that I see as a key driver into the land, water, and greenhouse gas impacts.
What about the impacts of chicken and poultry? What are you finding there?
I actually find they're a bit stuck in the middle overall. Okay. Outside of land impacts, they tend to rise close to the top when it comes to land impacts per meter squared. And that may have some implications when we think about deforestation and things of that sort, either domestically or internationally.
Yeah, I mean, with deforestation, it looks like we've lost thousands upon thousands of miles of forests. What role does this food production have on deforestation?
I like to use the example of meat production, or you can think of any food, maybe coffee, for instance. And it's not necessarily the amount of coffee you consume in the morning that has a direct impact on deforestation. But you have to think about the economic engine that drives the coffee to your table and all of the politics that happens in between that may yield a deforestation increase in Brazil, for instance. So these are these complex relationships that scientists are now trying to quantify with statistical significance so we can start making more informed decisions here domestically.
We have environmental science researcher Joe Bozeman with us from the University of Illinois at Chicago. We're examining how our dietary choices affect the environment, connecting the dots there with you as well. Farmers, are you doing something in particular to produce food while protecting the environment? How do you view sustainability in modern farming? How do you view food and sustainability? Join in with your insights, what you've learned about your local food system, 800-642-1234. So I'm wondering, Joe, should we stop eating meat altogether? Is that a solution?
Based on our findings and global dietary recommendations put out by the Eat Lancet Commission, no. The answer to that is no. Not unless you really, really want to.
Okay.
Instead, what we should be doing is reducing our meat intake by a little bit better than 50%. Based on our average numbers. And we also want to increase our nut intake, assuming you don't have a nut allergy, of course. And one thing that gets lost in a lot of this food talk is how we overconsume added sugars. And what I mean by added sugars are things like soda, some of the derivative sugar products we eat in a lot of our American food items. we do want to see a reduction of a little bit better than half there also.
You know, I love me some Impossible Burgers. Love those. What about fake meat? What about the plant-based stuff? Is that helpful?
You know, as a civilian and not as a scientist, when I look at that, I get excited, right? Because we're seeing a market shift where sustainable food is now in the conscience of many Americans. However, I have not seen a rigorous study performed on the life cycle cost of producing these Beyond Burger style meals. So it could be that the land greenhouse gas and water impacts that are yielded in more basic food items could be equivalent to these other styles. So we want to be careful on making large leaps towards this is the answer until the science backs it up.
Well, there's this elephant in the room, and it's the food waste. We waste so much food, throw so much away. Is that affecting how we approach our what is on our table and the outcomes of our environment?
So food waste does have a direct impact on greenhouse gas emissions if we tend to waste so many certain types of food items like beef and certain types of vegetables. They can emit off gas, but that's relatively small in comparison to the production level land greenhouse gas and water impacts. When it comes to food waste, what we want to do, and this is a dangerous thing to talk about because we have to think about the economy of food, but if we can utilize recyclable food programs so that we don't have as large of a food demand in certain communities, we can then see a broad shift towards healthier eating in more marginalized populations, as well as maybe a reduction in food access issues. But that's a bit more of a political and societal question than it is a raw, how much impact is food waste causing on the environment?
Yeah, explain that recyclable system there. What do you mean by that?
Well, for instance, many of us may be aware of grocery stores taking their ugly fruits and vegetables and maybe donating it to a local food pantry. Programs like that on mass scale, if we could figure out how to get food to where it's produced and maybe the demand is less to more urbanized and in areas that don't have as good food access, if we can get the food to those areas low cost, we can see a net increase in nutritional health, human health outcomes, as well as environmental outcomes, because those communities that are getting reduced cost food then have to spend less at the store on other food items, which then have their own life cycle impacts.
And that has implications on bottom lines in the economy.
Absolutely. So, I mean, if you're a store owner, maybe you want that demand to stay high, but if you're an individual citizen who's just looking for, you know, a nice tomato or a banana, you probably want those recyclable food products to come to your doorstep.
Greg from Fenimore called, couldn't stay with us. Greg wants to know if you've looked at the effects of regenerative farming practices that involve more grazing and what the implications are on meat.
I have, with a small team, started to look at that. I do not have rigorous science to talk about yet, but our early findings suggest that the regenerative farming approach can have really, really cool dynamic benefits on land use, right? Because the idea is you use land and you cycle through a larger square meter of land and come back to that grazed land using biodiverse approaches and things of that sort. If we do that well, our overall land use degradation and deforestation numbers and things of that sort become less important over the long term. But that's if we do it mass scale. Farmers have enough money to invest in those sorts of approaches, have support from either small community groups or governmental institutions to actually execute this. So I think we're in the beginning stages of seeing that this is going to work at an entire domestic level.
So you would need to see some policy shifts, policy changes in order to really get that regenerative farming practices going.
I think so. Not only do we need a policy shift in potential funding for the farmers, I think researchers are going to need a bit of a boost to really investigate these dynamics and the implications with a level of rigor that society will be willing to accept.
Yeah, because it becomes really complicated because all of these things are so interconnected. The system is really tight and dependent on so many other things in the food chain.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the things, if you don't happen to be in the farming business, I know a lot of your listeners probably know much more about actual farming than I do even. But to pay homage to them, one of the things that we find is the technological an intellectual effort to do true regenerative farming is a lot more involved than some of their staff can handle if they're already pushed to the max on labor. So these are some of the things we have to think about when we think about regenerative farming.
Joe Bozeman, researcher at the University of Illinois at Chicago Institute for Environmental Science and Policy. We're learning how to make a healthy diet for us and the planet. Do you work in food production? Has your organization made steps to reduce emissions? Are you concerned with the amount of emissions coming from points along the food chain? What changes could be more sustainable? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Joe Bozeman after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking about our diet and the climate. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Eat Lancet Commission on Healthy Diets brought together dozens of scientists from around the world last year to ask one key question. Can we feed a future population of 10 billion people a healthy diet within planetary boundaries? The answer is yes, but not without transforming our eating habits, improving food production, and reducing all that food waste. How do you make food choices at your house? Do you think about your food's environmental impact? 800-642-1234. Joe Bozeman is at the University of Illinois at Chicago Institute for Environmental Science and Policy. He's our guide. Joe, let's look at the vegan diet for a moment, the no meat, no eggs, no dairy. What about the vegan diet? How does that do for the climate?
Based on the Eat Lancet's global dietary recommendations, a vegan diet would work, mostly due to the fact we would see a significant reduction in beef and pork consumption, of course, and that is the biggest driver of greenhouse gas emissions across the board, it seems. We also probably would see a reduction in added sugars. Folks who tend to adhere to vegan diets and diets of similar kinds tend to make healthier choices when it comes to refined sugars and candies and chips and things of that sort. So that dietary approach, I think, would fall well within the global dietary recommendations.
Bob from Mauston called, couldn't stay, but Bob's been a farmer for many years. And Bob says, one of the problems is that artificial food is priced higher than our natural food. And that is an issue. Bob says it also takes carbon dioxide to grow plants. What would you say to Bob there on how we look at the foods that we eat, you know, the natural foods that we grow versus the artificial foods that Bob is talking about?
I empathize because it is true. There are times where artificial food items have been priced lower than your more natural food items. And this is where we have to use our voices individually and through our systems, governmental in part, to bolster our local food production activities, and also, and this doesn't get talked about all the time, also change policy so we can support our markets to facilitate the long-term survival of our local food production entities. I think it's pretty well known across the nation that we have shifted to more corporatized food production where, for instance, I use this story. I lived in Ohio for a great amount of time. Used to travel with my mother up to a local farm to buy corn. And now I go back to that same farm. They're growing things there, but I can no longer buy the corn from my local farmer. And that has a huge impact, not only on our food consumption and access to healthy food items, but to our culture, to our society at large. When it comes to And what was the second part of the caller's question? I forgot now. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And the caller was saying that, you know, the artificial food, the food that is, you know, produced with preservatives, things like that, has a lot more intensive, you know, work to be done to be able to create that food versus the food that just comes out of the ground or you know, produce.
Right. Sometimes that's true. Sometimes it's not.
Okay.
I really do think we miss the policy question. I think it has a lot to do with market support. There is a growing set of technological tools to be able to produce organic food items and get it to our customers and get it to the table in a cost-efficient and land, water, and greenhouse gas-efficient manner. But distance traveled, refrigeration along the distribution system, there are a lot of factors that come into the market aspect that require policy change and broad support from society.
When you talk about buying corn from that local farmer in Ohio, it makes me think of CSAs here, community supported agriculture, and those boxes of produce that land on our doorsteps through these CSA programs. What is the impact there on the environment?
I think it has been making a positive shift towards reimagining the way food comes to our tables. I mean, you can also add in these food delivery services. I happen to use one here in my own home. And I think that opens up the door for us to potentially add in local producers into these items. I think they're already incorporating local food producers into these delivery services. So I think this is a good shift when it comes to the environmental impacts and how this rolls up into global environmental change, or if you'd like to use the term climate change. I don't know for sure if we're going to make a significant dent there without the wholesale shifts towards more sustainable eating and food production habits that we've been talking about.
Well, here comes that question. You know, I am just one person or one family. Can I really make a difference here if I change my diet?
The answer to that is absolutely yes. And I like to think of it almost philosophically in a way. It requires a summation of individuals to make these shifts anyway. So I think sometimes we get a little bit lost in trying to change everyone else before we make a shift ourselves. And sometimes we underestimate the social power that each of us have in our individual families, in our churches, in our social groups. I know these days it's a little tougher to have that influence, but it does matter what you do individually. And to be specific, if the average American who tends to eat more meat than some other groups around the world, if we can reduce our meat intake on a daily basis by half, or do what I do in our household is try not to eat meat during the week and save it towards the weekend and balance it out in whatever way that fits your family, that can significantly have an impact on greenhouse gas emissions.
We're talking with Joe Bozeman, who researches what we eat and how that affects our environment. He's with the Environmental Science and Policy at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Are you concerned with how the food processing industry affects our environment? And if so, what solutions could be brought to reduce emissions and to have an effect on our warming planet? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in James, who's joining us from Green Bay this morning. Hi, James.
Hello. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm a truck driver, so logistics are kind of, you know, my life. A lot of people, they think, you know, trucks are bad for the environment, and I guess they kind of are. I work for a company that does all natural gas stuff for our trucks, but I want to point out that your vegetables, the frozen stuff you get, can take its time getting a much more fuel-efficient ride on, say, a refrigerated semi-trailer or a refrigerated train car than a lot of your fresh produce you find in the supermarket, which a lot of people don't know, is flown in. And I think we all know that airplanes, especially jets, are way worse for carbon emissions than trains and semi-trucks.
James, thank you for bringing that to the table. What do you see there between fresh and frozen, Joe?
Thanks, James, for that statement and in the question. It is true. moving to sustainable food production will require some shifts in the way we utilize our labor groups. However, there are electrification of vehicles that are being thought of. And we also are looking towards bolstering our local food production where maybe we don't have to fly in those fresh produce items as far or as often as we do today. So we are trying to approach this holistically. There is no question it's going to require subsidies and transition funding from probably state or federal government entities to allow us to survive this economic transition. And that's why I say we don't want to lose the policy conversation when we talk about some of the tangible changes we can make individually or in our localities.
In your research, you look at what demographics has to do with diet and what then that has to do with our climate. What are some of those demographic pinpoints that you've made here, and what are those observations?
Well, this is an area where we're really excited about. We are able to look at the individual dietary patterns of Blacks, Whites, and Latinx folks within the United States. And what we find is on a per person basis, per capita, the white demographic tends to consume food such that it impacts such that it impacts greenhouse gas and water the most, whereas the Black demographic tends to impact land the most. And some folks would wonder why that even matters. It does because we tend to live in urbanized and rural and peri-urban communities that lean towards one racial or ethnic group more than the other. And if we're going to make our local food production efficient, if we're going to fund and subsidize the right kinds of policies to allow this transition to occur, we're going to have to understand the individual community traits and trends and construct our policies to address those specific needs. And we find some very interesting things on the national scale. For the Black demographic, we find that they only meet 7 out of the 12 standards of the global dietary recommendation. Latinx is also 7 out of 12. And for the white demographic, we find that they meet 9 out of 12 standards. But it gets interesting. Even though the white demographic meets more of these global dietary recommendation standards than their counterparts, they tend to have the largest impact in greenhouse gas due to having the highest red meat intake. So there are these really interesting and complex relationships that our policymakers and researchers have to start incorporating into their activities.
We're looking at the foods we eat, what they do to our planet. Joe Bozeman, environmental researcher at the University of Illinois at Chicago. You can join in. Still time for you. Were you a first-time pandemic gardener? What did you grow? Have you found a way to stay connected with local farmers who are trying to get their harvest to us amid the pandemic? What point are you in the local food chain? What can you add here? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute, more conversation with Joe Bozeman here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Joe Bozeman. He's an environmental science researcher at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's helping us unpack our diet's impact on the global climate crisis and what changes we can make today, right now, at breakfast, to shift toward more climate-friendly foods. Let's bring in Chris now from Racine. Hi, Chris. What would you like to add?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Well, I just wanted to comment that I was a member of the National Geographic Blue Zone study, and our population in Loma Linda was judged to be the longest-lived population on Earth, along with a community in northern China. We were primarily vegetarians, don't smoke, don't drink, And it has been a huge impact on my life. My dad is 98 years old and still shoots par golf. I'm nearly 70 and I still work full time without any issues whatsoever. My normal breakfast is oatmeal with fruit on top, and I find that my food budget is about a third of what my meat-eating buddies eat. So that diet has totally worked.
Chris, thank you for bringing this. Joe, a vegetarian diet, and certainly not as costly as eating meat, Chris points out.
Thank you for those statements, Chris. And I wanted to thank you for also the work you did in the Blue Zone. I had a chance to see some of that research, if I'm not mistaken, or I've at least read about it. But to speak towards the vegetarian diet and how that can have an impact on your bottom line, as well as increase our chances of averting the worst of climate change and global environmental degradation. It is true that we could see wholesale benefits in every way that you can imagine. I know it sounds a bit far-fetched, but if we reduce our meat intake by around 50% or better than 50, you're probably going to spend less as an individual. You're likely to see human health benefits, potentially cognitive benefits if you increase your vegetable intake and your fruit intake in some cases and nut intake. And you're likely to see the kind of global environmental degradation benefits that we're all trying to navigate towards now that we're realizing some of our human activities have direct impact on our climate, as well as even our ability to produce food long term. So what Chris is saying is true. We've seen evidence of that and the science backs it up.
Chris, thanks for the call. Let's turn to Chelsea now from Northwest Illinois. Chelsea, hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, so I have a question for Joe. If we're recommending to do more of a plant-based diet, vegan diet, I should preface to say that I'm a registered dietitian nutritionist. What initiatives are we going to do to help provide education to individuals on how to prepare more of a plant-based diet? And what teaching tools are we going to give them to differentiate between a packaged product that is marketed as being vegan but may come with alternative health side effects, such as the preservatives and added sugars that might be inside of those products?
Yeah, Chelsea, thank you so much. Joe, you know, Chelsea being the dietitian there, wondering, how do you educate?
Thank you, Chelsea. I'm glad you asked this question. In our studies, we tend to make policy prescriptions and educational proposals. And one of our proposals is to use the United States Department of Agriculture and their DGA guidelines, Dietary Guidelines for America, to educate the broader public on these race, ethnic specific dietary trends, as well as the overall U.S. dietary trends. And we have what we call food consumption impact rates, where we've identified environmentally intense foods, have actually quantified an estimation of how much land, greenhouse gas, and water impacts are associated with these environmentally intense foods, and then can educate our subgroups or the U.S. population at large on which foods to moderate the intake of and moderate the purchasing of, not necessarily eliminate. The last point I wanted to bring up is vegetarian or vegan diets do fall within global dietary recommendation standards broadly. However, you don't have to give up meat to meet these global dietary recommendations. You can have a more Mediterranean style of a diet and meet all of your nutrition needs, as well as potentially stave off declining cognitive effects. So there are other diets and styles you can take rather than just the vegan or vegetarian approaches.
Well, here's a question. Why aren't there labels on the issue of education? Why aren't there labels in the grocery store explaining the carbon footprint of each food you're about to purchase? I mean, that would help me as a consumer.
It's funny you say that. I promise you could have plucked this paragraph straight from one of our studies. That's exactly what we've proposed to the FDA is to, if we know how much salt and sugar are in our meals, why shouldn't we know that this particular food commodity is land intensive or greenhouse gas intensive or water intensive? I think as consumers, we would change our behavior and purchase more balanced if we knew that information or we could see it clearly on a label. Executing that is super complex and will require a bolstering of staff, probably at the government level, and it would require closer connection between some government entities and scientists within the academic world and in the nonprofit world. So I think there would be a new political and social structure we would have to develop to effectively do that on an annual basis. I mean, think about how many food commodities come in and out of the American dietary patterns.
It's a lot of calculations there, right? Joe Bozeman with us. He's a research associate at the University of Illinois at Chicago Institute for Environmental Science and Policy. We discuss our food systems, climate change, and what to do next. Jim is with us from Jackson. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My point is that I'd like to see the amount of corn grown and eaten, especially by cows, greatly reduced because cows are not designed to eat corn. And that's why that's one of the main reasons why the methane that they produce is so excessive. If they eat grass like they're designed to eat, much less carbon footprint.
Yeah, so changing the diet of the cows is one way, one measure for sustainability. What do you make of that, Joe?
To be able to do that in a way that I think will satisfy the corporate powerhouses that facilitate these food items, such as cows and the meat they produce, milk they produce, we're going to have to probably have a shift in a few areas. One, we still need to reduce the amount of meat we eat overall. What that will do is potentially change the demand structure in the economy where we pay more per kilogram of meat, red meat that we consume and purchase. But we also may reduce the overall amount of cows that are needed to be cultivated, which then facilitates regenerative farming practices that we talked about earlier in this section. So these complex relationships, I know you can get, it feels like you're getting dizzy running in a circle, but it's incumbent upon us to understand these relationships and to find out how to leverage our behavior changes to facilitate healthy outcomes, not only for us as humans, but for the environment of which we exist in.
Well, we only have a few seconds left, but if there is a simple food choice I can make today that would reduce my climate footprint, what change would that be?
One that I like to highlight is reduce your red meat intake and increase your fish intake, because most of us do not overeat fish products, not in America at least.
Joe, thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate it, Kate. Thank you.
Joe Bozeman is a research associate at the University of Illinois at Chicago Institute for Environmental Science and Policy, where he studies how our diet affects the environment. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.